Okay, so I see you're ready to questions. You're moderating the question. Good.
Me? Yeah. Okay. Hi, it's Christian Döring. I have a question regarding the suppression of the small scales by the neutrino masses. I always mess that up a little bit. Maybe you can maybe explain it a bit. So if I understand it correctly, if you look at the like Bardeen perturbation theory or the cosmological perturbations, this neutrino free streaming, does it like induce this an anisotropic stress that suppresses the small scales? How does it work? How does it end up in the perturbation theory?
Okay, so in the standard model of cosmology, neutrinos are massless. Now, you may agree that this is incorrect because, you know, there are oscillations, but the moment, the time when the model was written down, this oscillation hadn't been discovered, so the neutrino could be massless. Also, given the size of the error bars and the statistical power of the survey and the data, assuming that massless or not really massless, well, it's not such a big difference, right? And so in the standard model, they were massless. And so if you have massless neutrinos, you can imagine you are a perturbation of dark matter that is collapsing under gravity. The neutrino behave like a relativistic particle. You don't care. You count all the mass, and according of the mass, you feel gravity, you collapse. Very good. Now, these neutrinos that are distributed around there have mass. So they also feel gravity. But they have a high velocity dispersion, they go fast. And so as they zoom through the dark matter halos, they can't cluster like the cold dark matter does and create a very spiky halo. They feel the dark matter, but they run fast. And so below the free streaming lens, compared to a model where we keep everything else the same and the neutrinos are massless, now you have a component of the dark matter that doesn't count anymore like cold dark matter and clusters, but takes part of the mass and runs away with it. And therefore it suppresses the perturbation on small scales. Now, this is what happened in the physical sense, because you say if you keep everything else fixed, but again, we are doing a multi-parameter model fitting to the observation. And so at the end of the day, to see how well your experiment will constrain what, you will have to move along the generalities of a given data set, and the generalities given by the given data set of the cosmological parameter, and see what constraint you get in the other cosmological parameter. But the physics is this one. Does this explain?
Yeah, thank you.
There were another question.
Yes, you mentioned at some point, I think, the Hubble tension.
Yes.
How does it affect this determination of the neutrino masses?
Okay. So among the degeneracy among the cosmological parameters, it turns out that the higher the Hubble constant is, the lower you need the neutrino mass. It's just because you have this multidimensional parameter space, and that's the way the degeneracy with the current data end up settling up. So, but we know that there is a tension in the lambda CDM with the Hubble constant, and we know that adding neutrino mass is not going to help. So you don't want to add a discrepant observation that is discrepant even for zero neutrino mass, and then use it to constrain the mass of the neutrino. You're going to have a wonderfully small error bars, a wonderfully tight upper limit, but maybe that's a little bit not, you know, it's precise but not accurate. So how else it could impact the determination of neutrino property from cosmology? It all relies on the fact that we say we have a wonderful model that it works so well. We only have six parameters, so we keep adding, you know, one or two, say, sum of neutrino mass or number of effective neutrinos, it still works so well. But I keep telling you it works so well, and you say, but you've hidden under the carpet the fact that H-naught doesn't work so well, and I've hidden it under the carpet. So the consensus is, If it ain't completely broken and you don't have you know, something else to substitute it, keep using it. But we have to keep in the back of our mind that there may be something there. However, what the direct determination of the Hubble constant does, it measures distances, redshift, and finds the relation between these two things. That's one thing. When we try to constrain the Hubble constant from cosmology, we're doing something completely different. We're saying we can only measure angles and redshifts. The theory gives us distances, so we have to convert one into the other, and to convert that, we need to put a little h in there. And we say that that little h is the same h that the Hubble Space Telescope measures by doing distances and redshift. That's a big if, right? So as long as these two determination of h agreed, then you know you declare victory, the model works extremely well. When they start not agreeing, you think twice before, you know, throwing the baby with the bathwater. You think, you know, maybe something is going on, I don't know what it is, and say, well, Adam, go and check your data again. He's been checking his data since 2013, poor thing, and nobody has found anything wrong, but, you know. So I don't know if this answered your question, but we could keep talking for hours about the Hubble constant, as you know.
Yes, Berens.
On this table, in this table with the different data sets that are being added, and then you get different constraints on the sum of the neutrino masses.
Let me find it for you, because that's the one that changed after deadline for sending. Here.
Yeah, so there is this Di Valentino et al. One which adds 5 parameters,
yes.
Right? Can you comment a bit on what kind of parameters are added and what is the motivation for adding those parameters?
So what the motivation is, what we've done so far in this column is to say we take the lambda CDM and we only add one parameter to the basic 6 parameter, and this parameter is the sum of neutrino masses. That's in an Occam sense, that's what you want to do. But then you could say, you know, again, you're fitting a parameter of a model. What about if we leave more freedom to this model? So you can start adding curvature. You can start say the dark energy is not a cosmological constant. Maybe it's something varying. You can say maybe the primordial power spectrum is not a power. You can start doing things like that. And then, of course, the constraint relax a little bit because you have added a lot of parameters to the model, and also because a lot of the constraints that come from the baryon acoustic oscillations, wherever you see plus BAO, you're adding information about the expansion history. Because you're saying, I have something that behaves like radiation and then behaves like matter. So it changes the expansion history of the universe. If now you say, but the dark energy is not a cosmological constant, it's something that varies in time, of course it can mimic. And you can exchange one thing for the other, and that's why the constraint relax. Again, I think this is a sanity check to say how much do the constraint relax if I want to be very, very, very permissive.
So just out of curiosity, what is your favorite way to solve the Hubble tension problem?
Okay. Shall we discuss that after dinner and the Marsala, or shall we discuss So I think there are only two possible solutions to me. My argument for getting there is a little bit long, and some of it is based on unpublished material, but I give you the result. There are only two possible solutions. Either one solution is extremely local, which means it happened, you know, almost in front of our eyes. It happened where we don't have BAO and where the supernova are not yet well calibrated, which says it happened cephades and down in the cosmic distance ladder. It's very local. Or it's such a global problem that I have to tinker both with the early time physics and the physics in the middle. Because if I only tinker with early time physics, we've been going around this for I don't know how many years. The theorists have tinkered with it I don't know how long, and they really have very, very little wiggle room. I mean, maybe a smarter theorist will find it, but the wiggle room for messing around with early time physics is tiny. So, but you need to do something. If you mess around with early physics, you have to mess around with the late time physics too to still match the observations. So from an Occam resource point of view, maybe you want to say look locally, but I don't know. But I think, you know, you can't just say, let's mess around with early time physics. That seems to me. But after Marcel, I'll tell you more.
Christian Döring, I have a second question. So what happens when the neutrino masses, the sum of the neutrino masses you get from the cosmology and the direct measurements of the neutrino's mass don't fit?
Yeah,
what is then the plan, what to do?
So say Catherine finds something and the cosmology still tells you, no, the neutrino mass is below 0.1 eV. Then I think we really need to scratch our head, because it's very hard to get such a good fit and then mess around with the properties of neutrino. Maybe we know there are at least three neutrinos there. So we can try to, as I will show you tomorrow, you can try to ask, have we really seen neutrinos? And then the answer will be, well, it walks like a duck, it smells like a duck, chances are it's a duck. What we haven't done yet is to say, well, there are three neutrinos, and then maybe there is something else that is not neutrino, but behaves similarly. So then you have to consider not changes of the model where you have this well-established model, and then you do one parameter deviation in the direction of the neutrino mass or number of effects. Maybe you have to sort of reconsider it all and do strange decoupling, strange thermality, who knows?
And maybe a very fast question. On your slide about the baryon acoustic oscillations, I think, you showed this picture where you basically have the zoom from the CMB, and then you showed that you can, like, I think, connected with galaxy clusters or so. Is it really like you can...
Is it
can
this
really
one or this one?
Yeah, I think or one... Either, I think this one, yeah, this lower one. Is it really like that I can really correlate them one-to-one? And
statistically.
Statistically, yeah.
So when you do the correlation one-to-one, I take the map of the cosmic microwave angle, I take the map of the galaxy and I cross-correlate, what I would see primarily will be either gravitational lensing or the integrated Sachs voltage. It has nothing to do with this. But what you're saying is, in those oscillations there that I see like a pattern, I'm seeing the sound oscillation, there is a standard ruler, which is the sound horizon at recombination. Now, what you see in the large scale structure is the sound horizon a little bit later, which is a radiation drag, but the two are so close to each other and so tightly related that you can't really, you know, keep one fixed and dramatically change the other, although we've tried to solve the Hubble tension and it gets you halfway there, but not the whole way by doing some very, you know, crazy things. So yes, statistically it is the same ruler.
So basically this blue, I don't know if I can really read it like one to one, but the blue spot that
why I show it this way. So what you will see, you will see more something like this. Where is the animation? This. So that standard ruler will tell you where this acoustic peaks land. And then that same standard ruler will tell you where this acoustic peaks land. Note, however, that this is in unit of K over H, while this is in unit of angle. So again, that's an H come out straight out of there.
I see, and inside this baryon acoustic oscillation, but in the side the sound horizon, you expect an underdensity, right?
So if it is an overdensity, you expect an overdensity in the middle. And actually, they've done it in the CMB. They haven't done it in the large scale structure. It will be a nice thing to do visually when there's not much science out of it. So they took all the cold spots, which are overdensity. And then they try to stack them and see whether they see this wave going out that stops at recombination, and that's the blue.
This was exactly my question, basically, because I saw that there's this blue spot and that it corresponds
to that. And in the galaxy, you should also see the same, and it would be very nice if somebody actually tried to do that. That they did it at the last Planck data release, and nobody has thought about doing with galaxies because there's not much scientific value, but in terms of illustrative value, it would be cool.
Thank you.
My name is Vladislav Barinov, and unfortunately, Christian stole my first question, but it's no problem. My question is, what are the future prospects, I mean, the direct measurements of neutrino mass in future, after Katrine, for example? New experiments, what's plan?
That I think there are probably people in this audience that know much better than me what the future hopes are for direct constraint on the neutrino mass. But again, terrestrial experiment will tell you the mass of, for example, of the electron neutron, will not tell you the sum of the masses. While cosmology has problem in seeing the flavor or seeing the different mass eigenstate, although we can always try, but give you the sum of the masses. And so the two approaches are complementary. And again, you can relate them within a model. But we're still waiting for Katrine.
Okay.
So Katrine released early this year their best limit so far, which is 0.8 eV, but just for one mass. And so the best you can do, you multiply by 3, and you get the limit on the sum of the masses. They'll do better. I think their limit is, their target limit is 0.8 upper limit for all of the masses. That is, you know.
Okay, thank you.
0.2 something for each mass. There are two that ones, since you didn't ask yet, do you want to go ahead and then?
So you showed these plots about with the polarization of the CMB, and I have several questions. First, like, how do we measure the polarization? Then also, why is it, I think it's very difficult, and why is it so difficult to measure it? And if there is some relation with inflation or not yet, we don't have any results to, because it's related to.
Oh, yeah, okay. So there's a lot to unpack here. The CMB photons are polarized, and what we are interested in is linear polarization. The way you measure the polarization of the CMB, you simply have observed the sky with something that let the photon pass only if it aligns. Like if you were putting a slit, but it's not really a slit, it's an optical that will tell you like a slit, and then the photon will pass if it's aligned with the slit, and then you go around the sky with the slit aligned in a different way and see where the thing goes through. So to measure the intensity, you get all the photons. To measure the polarization, you get a reduced number of photons because you put the slit in front. On top of that, the polarized signal of the CMB is reduced at least an order of magnitude compared to the temperature. So it's more difficult to measure because you lose photons, and therefore by losing photon, you need more sensitivity, so the detector are already photon limited. So what you want to do, you want to put many more pixels, and you want to have a focal plane that is this high, and a telescope that is even bigger, right? That's the way you do it. And then you integrate for longer, but then you need stability, so that's why it's difficult. And the other question was, how does it help? Well, it helps because we know that is the same kind of perturbation that generate the temperature, also generate the polarization. And therefore, the temperature predicts the polarization, but also from the polarization itself, you can also do the same type of analysis you do from the temperature. You can check if they agree with each other, and then if they agree, you combine them. And it turns out that in the last Planck release, they do so well with polarization that polarization has got almost as much statistical power as the temperature, which is wonderful. Now, it's true, polarization is also related to inflation. In what way? When you measure polarization, you measure QU modes, which is something that is delocalized. What the theory tells you, it tells you that what's interesting are the E modes, which modes that have no handiness. But then when you decompose a film, it's a little bit like the EB, the composition for electromagnetism, you also, in principle, have B. Now, scalar perturbation only give you E. But if you have inflation with primordial gravitational waves, then you have both E and B. So you have a component of B. And so you can try to put a limit on how much B mode you saw, keeping in mind that lensing would also create B modes. So, but you go to larger scales and then there's no lensing. There is a little problem there. We live in a galaxy. The light from the galaxy is polarized, and the galaxy doesn't know about E and B. The galaxy spews out polarized stuff, both in E and B. And so if you remember the famous bicep result that ended up in all the newspaper, we found a tensor to scalar ratio of about 0.2, and then we have seen the primordial beam from the inflation, and YouTube videos of interviewing the person that actually predicted that, and so on and so forth. Dust is polarized, and there's a lot of dust out there. So one has got to be very, very, very careful and observing many, many, many frequencies, because the galaxy is not a black body, and so doesn't emit the same in a black body spectrum in all frequencies, and therefore the pattern also in the polarization will be different, and that's how you subtract the galaxy. So there's a lot of study, a lot of money, and a lot of effort going in to try to detect primordial B modes. As usual, you will want to go to space, because you get the best, you know, you get low noise, thermostability, etc. But the funding agency, before you go to space, demonstrate that you've done anything and everything you can do from the ground. And so now the effort is from the ground. The atmosphere is not really polarized, so that helps. If the atmosphere was also polarizing, then you go, I give up.
And the follow-up question, so how do we know that it's the polarization is due to the cosmic dust and not something else? Like, how can we tell that it's...
Oh, because the moment you're serving more than one frequency, then you know that whatever is there doesn't behave like what you expect from a black body radiation. And then we don't know exactly how the polarized, say, synchrotron and dust work as a function of frequency. Exactly, we don't know, but more or less we know. And if you see something that doesn't look like a black body, but looks a lot similar to what you expect the dust to be, and it's somewhat correlate with intensity of the dust maps too, it's very likely to be dust. And that's basically the effort that went to understand what was going on with the bicep result.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, so my question was, it's a bit related to the earlier one, but how about the future cosmological measurement? For example, if in the next generation observatories one can measure the tensor to scalar ratio, mm-hmm. does it have implications also for these neutrino mass or number of neutrino flavors, or is it mostly unrelated?
So it is related, because again, in cosmology, everything is degenerate with everything else. So if you remember when I did, let me show you the plot here. Rather than if you remember, let me just show it to you. Here. So you remember this plot when I say, you know, I tell you all this story, you keep fixed omega matter, omega lambda, and then you have this nice suppression that goes like the fraction of matter in neutrinos, and that's a linear theory, fine. But then if I move along the CMB, the degeneracy, I keep the location of the peak fixed, I keep matter radiation, the transition between matter and radiation equality the same, et cetera, et cetera. Then I get the solid line and not the dashed line. You see that the solid line have a different amplitude, okay? Now, if you look at the cosmic microwave background, the normalization of the primordial power spectrum, which, you know, will give you also something like this in the larger scale structure, is degenerate with partly degenerate with something. What is that something? And now we have to invoke the end of the Dark Ages when the universe gets reionized by the first stars. If the universe gets reionized by the first stars, you have again free electrons. You have free electrons in front of something that you thought was neutral, and then you're going to alter what you see in the cosmic microwave background. So the degeneracy, this parameter is the optical depth, the last scattering surface, the famous tau, and the degeneracy goes almost like EA, the amplitude of primordial power spectrum, E to the minus something tau. Okay, how do I constrain tau? Polarization again, because now I have free electron in front of me, and those free electrons will create polarization. But now these free electrons come from structures that are not at the last scattering surface. They are much closer to my eyes. By being much closer to my eyes, this is going to be on the larger scale. And so constrain better polarization means constrain better the integrated optical depth to the last scattering surface, constrain better the amplitude, and therefore when you move along the CMB degeneracy, constrain better neutrino masses. Physically, they have nothing to do with each other, unless somebody says if you put too much massive neutrinos, you can't form star early enough, and then you don't reionize the universe. But it's a much more messy argument, much more nonlinear. Very few people will believe you.
Ms. Amanish, so at some point you mentioned the huge number of neutrinos radiated from the sun. And I wonder how much pollution of neutrinos do we measure from the stars? And is it problematic if you want to construct a neutrino wave background?
So if you want to detect neutrino directly, or if you want to do cosmology, they don't matter. There are a lot, but the universe is big. Therefore, the universe one really, really, really dominates. If you want to do a direct detection of the cosmic neutrino background, then you play with the energy, because the energy of the neutrino from the sun is not the same as the energy of the cosmic neutrino background. So if you want to detect that one, just go at the right energy.
Okay, thank you.
So sorry if this is a basic question, but like that 6 parameters that we have in the lambda CDM model, we obtain them from the fit of the power spectrum, correct, of the CMB. Do we have other sources? How can we check them with other sources? Like, would primordial gravitational waves help cosmic neutrino background? Because how do we can check this?
This is a wonderful question. It's a question that I think people should ask themselves the moment they've satisfied that they've shrunk the error on the cosmological parameter enough and then move beyond constraining parameter and trying to understand the physics behind. So there's a lot to unpack into your question. Let's see if I can, you know, select some things that are gonna be useful. So there are some things that even though you may be doing parametrically, you can have an insight on the physics of what's going on. For example, if you know that you are a measuring probe that only tests the universe expansion history, you know you are testing the universe expansion history. Anything that messes up with the growth of structure, you will not see. Or at least you have a way to disentangle the two effects. But yes, there is always, and you don't see only the cosmic microwave background. You see the cosmic microwave background primary. You see the polarization. You see the secondary effect. You see the integrated source wolf. You see the lensing. You see the large scale structure. You see lensing of that. there are a lot of probes. So what I presented here is, as I was saying, put everything in the kitchen sink together. But, you know, we are cosmologists. How did Landau say it? Often in error, but never in doubt. But we've learned our lesson, and then before we put everything in the kitchen sink, we started doing one probe at a time, and then if they are consistent, we start combining a few, and then we add some more, and then we add some more, and that gives you some level of confidence in what you find. But your question goes along the line of precision by itself is not enough. You need precision and accuracy. And accuracy is not just the systematic error in your instrument. Accuracy is also the model I use and the modeling I'm using. Are they the appropriate one? I would always find some number for some cosmological parameter with some error bar, but what does it mean? So thank you.
Thanks.
Yes. I was thinking about the bound you were referring to this morning about the number of neutrino species. This number is very important because apart from constraining really the number of neutrino species, maybe what is more interesting is that it constrains the possible presence of new degrees of freedom, or light degrees of freedom. Now, I was wondering if you have right-handed neutrinos in addition to left-handed neutrinos. So in particular, suppose just a very plain model where you have just light Dirac neutrinos. So the normal neutrinos, suppose for a moment that they are Dirac neutrinos.
You want me to tell you tomorrow class now? Basically, I'm going to talk about this tomorrow.
Ah, you have the answer. Okay. Yes. No, if you want, we can postpone to tomorrow. My question was if this light, new light degrees of freedom, which are kept in equilibrium because they interact with the left-hand neutrino, but this is just an example. We could put some other light particle in equilibrium. If there is still room left for a particle like this, or you think that really now the bound on delta NF, N effective, okay, is really so strong to exclude this possibility.
So the limit I reported on delta NF is assuming that they are neutrinos, which means that they are an imperfect fluid with exactly the same property of neutrinos. Now, of course, one could relax this assumption, and people have done that, and then you open up a whole zoo. So to first order, what the cosmology is sensitive to is just you have something extra that behaves like radiation at the background level. That's the booming signal. But then if you go into the detail and you start digging into the signal to noise, then there are signatures of neutrino that you can parameterize as viscosity and as effective sound speed. And there's some information there. I think there was another question, but I think my time is up. So do you want to ask me the question later?
Yeah, maybe it's just tomorrow. Another interesting question is the lepton-anti-lepton asymmetry. Can you, in principle, there could be a big asymmetry, bigger than what you expect. Can you put a limit on this from cosmology?
I haven't seen a lot of work being done into that, so I don't know. We have to look it up, sorry. Interesting, but okay, my time is up.